Malloy here. Time for another story and another trip through the Wind Door. Hello, listeners, and welcome to Part 2 of Episode 8, wherein we discuss the novel Secret Rooms, the Definitive Edition. Before we get back into our original discussion, I would like to share in brief a point Toby made in response to the trim discussion about the importance of overcoming fear in the world of New Century. Toby was essentially reflecting on that first half of Chapter 6, where Annie Oakley is trying to reach out an olive branch to Catherine, and convince her that she is making the right choice in both sharing the story of her life and in offering the services of James and Abigail to the RSA. We have always seen Catherine as the eminently practical sort, but it doesn't change the fact that after having no one to rely upon but herself for so many years, that trust of an outsider would not come easily. Catherine herself makes remarks on that. And there is a notable symmetry between Catherine holding out her hand to James in the final moments of Chapter 1, and here in Chapter 6, where Catherine finally gives Annie permission to call her by her familiar name. Women being more easily able to come to terms with each other and form alliances in times of strife is a recurring theme in New Century, and you may recall we spoke extensively about the dynamics between Rebecca, Amanda, and Cleo in Let Them Go. Mind, this isn't meant to be us throwing stones at men. There are a number of male characters in this series that show themselves capable of preventing fear, ego, or coveting of power getting in the way of trust and community. But as we proceed through this story, you won't need me to point out the number of men that desire a return to a time when they were masters of all they surveyed. But that's for future discussions. Right now, let's get back to talking about our hero. James and Abigail really are two of a kind in that they are very different kinds of personality. And as I said, I saw the similarity between James and the Sherlock Holmes that Robert Downey Jr. portrayed. I don't have a strong idea of someone that Abigail directly relates to. The closest that I come to was the portrayal of Calamity Jane in Deadwood, played by Robin Weigert, but mainly because, you know, they're both very emotional and not forthright precisely, but like blunt lady gunsmiths.
If I was failing to come up with a similar archetype for Abigail, it's because a lot of the women warriors I grew up with don't match up exactly. She's not carefree enough to be Faith and not angsty enough to be Buffy. Leia's not physical enough, and Ivanova is far too in control of herself. She doesn't have Sarah Connor's intensity, Wonder Woman's purity, or Zoe Washburn's sheer confidence. She isn't boisterous enough to be Jennifer Walters, or trying to be one of the guys like Private Vasquez. Perhaps I would have more potential influences to draw on if I watched more Westerns. But I kind of like that Abigail is as unique as she is. She feels like someone that fits well into her world, while being someone that is also a more idealized version of a tough woman that I'd want to see in that era. Taught by her father to fight, taught by her mother to feel, taught by Catherine to lead. She didn't grow up in the kind of world that would have made it difficult for women in general, and even more so for women not fitting into traditional roles. That's why Calamity Jane is an imperfect fit as well. She is the way she is because of toxic men. And while it's not hard to see Sharon in there as well, as the woman that voices her, these are still the early days, before Sharon felt as comfortable putting herself in Abigail's headspace. But that's a story for another time.
Abigail has a quality of, you know, she leads with her fists sometimes, she leads with her emotions, and it doesn't always necessarily take her down the best path. I mean, we see that enough from her interactions with Tommy Sweeney once upon a time. Maybe he deserved to be punched,
But, you know, it wasn't so definitely the most diplomatic thing to do.
And we see her regret that, or at least reconsider that instinctive reaction, which felt like the right thing to do at the time. But in retrospect, she does regret, or at least question if things would have turned out differently. But please carry on with your thought before you lose it because of my interjection.
Fair enough. I was going to say that in general, Abigail feels pretty smart. But what you said, she doesn't have James's book learning or retention of facts as revealed in that early interaction with Lucy. She doesn't have a head for figures, but she's strong and she's capable and she's more than willing to put her money where her mouth is in terms of getting work done and trying to figure out how to take care of things on her own level using the strengths that she does have.
Up to a point, of course. Abigail isn't without ego. She knows her own worth, and therefore chafes under Annie's direction on Rutledge Road, and takes supreme offense to being sent to the Cabbage Patch in Elkview. While she was likely willing to do whatever was needed back in Weirwood, as Catherine's get-stuff-done girl, there is the implication she was in a position of authority to decide or help decide what those things were. In that case, there was likely a certain familiarity that meant Catherine would accept Abby's opinion in these matters, regardless of coarse bluntness. Fortunately for Abigail, she meets someone that understands the finer points of diplomacy, as we'll talk about later.
But yeah,
speaking of Abigail's sort of proactiveness and things like that, I would like to sort of turn our attention towards, if you're up for it as well, the shootout sequence with the two new additions to the cartographers.
New additions, yeah.
Yeah.
I would want to make a clarification at this point, due to potential misspeaking during my original conversation with Toby. The cartographers are specifically the scouts of the Army of the Unified States of America. They have authority and responsibilities above and beyond normal enlisted men and women, even if they use the same titles of rank. Carl and Virgil join the RSA Army, but that does not make them cartographers. The books never get into how they are chosen or specifically trained above and beyond other enlisted soldiers, but Abigail does make reference in these chapters that she has some expectation of special training. As later chapters will imply, the status of James and Abigail as cartographers is provisional at best. More on this later.
It's a great sequence and one that I've enjoyed listening to the audio drama version of it. Maybe it's because of Alex's particular vocal performance for Carl and how he takes certain cues from things, like when Carl says, "I'm the leader, I'll say what we do," is very apparently, I think I remember him mentioning that was inspired by the Aristocats, the Disney animated film of all things, and there's this sort of dog duo who are sort of comedic side characters, and one of them has this recurring thing where, like, the other says something and the one who fancies himself the leader will just go, "I'm the leader, I'll say when it's done," and then immediately say, "Okay, it's done." But I think that they immediately establish Carl as someone who, despite the fact that they have just attacked our main characters, you can kind of immediately grasp the feel of the situation, that these guys are not the bandit kings that Annie surmises they ain't. They're a couple of people who are trying to get by, and just Carl's nickname of "fuck you" is just a great little thing to just deflate the tension. Actually, I remember you had a talking point about Annie's trick with the cards and everything. Would you like to take that?
Well, it was something that I brought up along the way. I didn't necessarily know that I wanted to devote any extra time to it because I was just curious about your thoughts on it. It's significant in that it's a callback to the life that she held in the original flow of historical events, is that, like Calamity Jane, she toured and was, you know, making a living off of doing tricks with shooting cards and other kinds of trick shots and everything like that. In this particular case, she uses it to effect in order to sort of be like the difficult persuasion tactic here, in order to get Carl and Virgil onto their side without any further risk of loss of life or whatever, saying that, you know, the implication there, which I didn't necessarily understand at first, is that they're trying to say, well, why should we believe that you're not going to shoot us if we throw away our guns and say, yeah, we'll go ahead and work with you? And the conclusion that you and I came to in our side conversation,
to use a movie reference that I know Alex loves, Carl and Annie facing off is not unlike the Man in Black and Fezzik facing off against each other, but with the roles reversed.
I did that on purpose. I don't have to miss.
I believe you. So what happens now?
We face each other as God intended. Sportsmanlike. No tricks, no weapons. Skill against skill alone.
You mean you'll put down your rock and I'll put down my sword and we'll try and kill each other like civilized people?
I can kill you now.
Frankly, I think the odds are slightly in your favor at hand fighting.
It's not my fault being the biggest and the strongest. I don't even exercise.
You think you're being all clever hiding behind rocks, but I am just this good. She is trying to convince them that they have no chance of success if they don't go along with her plan.
One of the terms I've heard used before is that every shaman is also at least a little bit of a showman, and the reverse is also true. It's clear Annie understands the principles behind this. Her skill with guns isn't magic, but it is still a form of intimidation. Too much intimidation will make someone respond with fear instead of reason. But her words alone also may not be enough. Real life shows us that you can have all the facts you want on your side, and people may still not respond to wisdom or logic. Therefore, sometimes it helps to have a little bit of showmanship in your back pocket.
It's surprising how comedic, as you say, that moment is, considering that she's trying to convince them to go along with her even after she's killed two of their friends. Yeah, they're bandits, but, you know, the implication there is that they were all still working together and getting along with each other. So it's a complicated tightrope to walk there.
It is, and I think that Annie herself, audience, if I hesitate whenever I read out Annie or Abigail's name from here on out, it's because there is a certain difficulty of when in a moment you're trying to recall name that begins with an A. Abigail, shit. Anyway.
For the record, I have also had the same issue. It's one of the reasons I try to avoid using the nickname Abby for Abigail, because then the names just sound more like each other.
Annie kind of admits that half the time this doesn't work because, you know, it's all down to a huge range of factors and random bits of mitigating circumstances. And if this were anyone else, who maybe the two bandits that she killed would have been like their brothers, and there would be no way they would take that sitting down. You know, it could have been anything, but she tries because, as she says, half the time it does. It's a sort of dialogue option where it says like a 50% chance success, and it's like, well, I may as well try it.
Every time one of us makes a reference that only people that play video games or otherwise massive geeks will get, I imagine a non-geek watching us like Picard and Riker trying to understand the aliens in the episode Darmok. The joke there is that I just explained one geek reference with another geek reference. But for the three people listening that don't understand, look up dialogue trees on Wikipedia or TV Tropes. Skipping forwards in our original conversation, I want to give credit to Toby for elucidating the showmanship factor of Annie's stunt before I did, and even commenting on how it was as much to influence Abigail as it was Carl and Virgil. This led to a further point of significance, why even making the attempt was worth the effort.
The other thing that is significant about this moment and is going to be a recurring theme and is actually going to be significant in terms of overall character development is something that Alex wanted to introduce into his story relatively early on. There are going to be many moments of action and fighting,
and with it, the potential for lasting harm or even loss of life on either side.
but he wanted to espouse an overall philosophy of not devolving into violence as the answer to every situation, particularly not simply for its own sake. You know, that the importance was to avoid potential loss of life whenever possible on both sides, but also the importance of never having action scenes or having battles that would significantly impact, you know, who's going to live and who's going to die, and have it be cool, you know, which is, there are large aspects of that in a lot of action movies where, you know, there's a really cool moment that happens, but, you know, it's either at significant loss of life or significant collateral damage where you're just thinking like, oh God, how many people just died in that moment just to have something cool happen in an action movie.
The Matrix lobby scene comes to mind where, yeah, you know, it's a fantastic technical display of choreography and everything. And then when you just remember the simple like story context, you go, are we still following the heroes right now? Because
that
wasn't really cool, like, at all.
Or more significantly, whenever a fight scene or wherever a running action scene happens on a highway or other, where there's a lot of cars crashing everywhere and you don't know how many of these people are still going to be alive after the fact. You certainly get the feeling for, in say a movie like one of the Terminator movies or something like that, we're following our heroes and we don't want them to die, but there's a whole lot of extra collateral damage going on all around them. And the only reason why this is more significant is not just because, oh, well, there are heroes and we're supposed to want them to succeed no matter whom else dies along the way. But in the case of the Terminator movies in particular, if these people die, then everything dies. So, you know, we can have a few smashed eggs along the way, so to speak. Not a very appetizing metaphor there. But Alex went into this and he's basically said, look, there's going to be action scenes and there's going to be some cool moments, but he never wanted to make life cheap. He wanted there always to be significant stakes going on there, and that the pulling out of the guns and the taking of life was always a last resort rather than, you know, the go-to option as Abigail would have had it or anything like that.
Abigail's trick shot therefore becomes not unlike the A-Team managing to defeat their enemies with guns, and yet without actually shooting anyone.
Or, as I like to call it, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles school of weapon use.
Where they just manage to do, like, awesome katas or whatever, and not actually kill anybody. Yeah, yeah.
These are for robots only.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's the thing, is that the two turtles have bludgeoning weapons, which could be used to take down opponents without killing anybody. But, you know, if you're using Psy to stab people as opposed to break weapons, or you've got Leo with his two katanas, yeah, I don't know. Let's come up with some robots that we can have Leonardo or Wolverine fight so they can use their super sharp edged weapons without killing anybody.
Yeah.
Mind, Toby and I aren't just poking fun at this oft-used trope. We're both huge fans of the new She-Ra cartoon, where the protagonist's weapon is a massive sword, and there are robots aplenty to use it on. But in that case, the sword is also a metaphor. More than once, She-Ra shapeshifts it to take whatever form she needs to solve the problem at hand, including things that are not weapons. And the show itself encourages communication as the best method to resolve differences. In the case of New Century, Alex splits the difference between the real world and a more ideal world. Actions have consequences, and often a cost to pay. For new readers, keep that idea in mind. It's going to come up again in different forms.
Well, there's one more thing that I wanted to touch on before we wrapped up, and that is the introduction of yet another character in these first four chapters, Tabitha Chorley.
Now,
yeah, Tabitha's here. Now, as referenced in Abigail's interaction with her, this is, in theory, not the first time that this character has shown up. We just won't get to hear a whole lot more. Like, there will be a little more of her in secret rooms, but this is a character that was originally introduced in the Cartographer's Handbook, because where that is a story that is meant to include a whole lot of vignettes about the activities and lives of a whole lot of different people that were involved with the outbreak of the Wendigo or the rebuilding effort through the RSA, that is her initial introduction into this story. This is the first time that y'all are hearing about it, but there's a nice little connective tissue of through line, particularly since while listeners may not have experienced the Cartographer's Handbook yet, for those of you that are new readers of the series, Abigail herself has, and she points to us like, hey, I know you.
I'm Tabitha.
The one from the book?
Actually, yes, that's me.
Jeepers, this is the first time I've met a famous person. Well, I mean, except Annie Oakley. Can you... No. Yes, actually, can you sign my book?
That's a neat little moment of rapport that's being built up there. But it's also significant in, like, not just that the introduction of Tabitha isn't just about having ongoing continuity between what at that point would have been the two books that Alex had written, but we need to further develop Abigail's character by having her interact with somebody. And since she's clearly not getting along with Annie that well, and she's already alluded to the fact that, you know, she could spend time with James, but James is kind of off doing his own thing with Frank Butler. We need someone sympathetic that Abigail can bounce off of so that we can see her in different kinds of circumstances. So Tabitha, in this case, is a good jumping off point so that we can see more of the world and more of Abigail interacting with that world. Significant because this is the first person that she's met that she feels like she can have an honest and enjoyable conversation with, as opposed to her fellow cartographers while working in the fields or while having a meal or anything like that.
And it also establishes quite an interesting comparison between Tabitha and Lucy in terms of, like, these two characters that Abigail seems to get along well with, is that they are both people who kind of inspire hope for Abigail, because Lucy was someone who was the optimistic mathematician, someone who, you know, wasn't sort of blindly saying, oh, it'll all be all right, never mind. She, like, saw the world for what it was, but saw a hopeful way of dealing with things that could, you know, inspire a bit of, like, action and actually sort of moving forward with the sense that things might be all right if we can just do this.
A brief sidebar. It wasn't until hearing Toby refer to Lucy by her chapter heading that something clicked for me, although I'm not sure if it actually means anything. You see, even though each of the noted chapters include more than just the character referenced, it is still using poetic license to refer to our major players. James is the lonely boy, Lucy the optimistic mathematician, and now Tabitha is the solitary pianist. Even Frank and Annie are denoted as the cartographers, which still works because even though they don't get a descriptive adjective, the fact that they are referenced together denotes that they are a battle couple. And while none of these terms are necessarily indications of archetype, the repeated use is following a pattern. Hell, many of the chapters follow a form of the adjective noun. Only Abigail herself is left out of that pattern, where her introductory chapter is collectively referring to the children of Clearwater. Not just her, but her siblings, the unnamed others that went with them to Weirwood, and even the ill-fated Tommy Sweeney. I suppose pointing this out would have been a better use of my time if it actually led to any interesting conclusions. But I will point out two things to round out this sidebar. First, that a well-crafted chapter title can prepare the reader for what comes next, while not giving too much away, instead inspiring curiosity. Alex has always been pretty good at that. And second, the pattern of naming a chapter after the central subjects of it is a pattern that Alex repeats in later books. Unfortunately, there was no good place to put that train of thought, as if I separated it out too far away from the initial entry point that spurred it, it would come across as a non sequitur. So let me return you to Toby's original point, where he was explaining the similarities between Lucy and Tabitha.
And with Tabitha, Abigail specifically says, I like the way you ended your story because it did have that sense of hope. And I think that Abigail responds well to that sort of measured, hopeful optimism. Abigail has a somewhat cynical streak to her in the sense that because she's had to be on guard, she's been in this like fortress settlement for 9 years. And so for as much as she is very proactive and outgoing, she is doing so with one hand ready to, you know, punch or shoot someone. So it's a case of when she sees someone who inspires a certain sense of comfortable light to them.
Light is a clever choice of word there, but we'll get into that in our final breakdown on secret rooms.
She responds positively to that, and I think that Tabitha is a good character to bring in, especially in the original way this would have been set up, where by this point we haven't actually seen Abigail respond positively to someone, and you kind of need to have the reader or listener enjoy and like Abigail. And there's a lot to like about her beforehand, just a lot of her narration and what she writes or records in her own journal is really like fun to hear her talk about. But it is always going to be pleasant to hear someone enjoying the company of someone else. And I think that Tabitha is a really good partner for Abigail in this scene.
You do mention she shows a different side of herself in her journal entries. And I very much like the off-the-cuff metaphors that Abigail is in the habit of using. It's come up a couple of times. And at least one occasion, there was a metaphor that Alex just came up with that he gave to Abigail. The turn of phrase in question had actually come from all the way back in episode 3, and from a serious moment, but I think you'll agree that its use kind of brings a smile to one's face.
We had emptied ourselves, and became receptive to sustenance and rest. And that's a markedly better scenario than trying to fill up a bag when there's already cats inside.
That's so good.
Yeah, that really is a great turn of phrase. That is one of her ongoing features. But I think I agree with you that, you know, she has a complicated relationship specifically with strong-willed women like her that are in a leadership capacity. Because even as she admires both Annie and Catherine Holloway, there is still butting heads, because at the end of the day, Abigail strives for and wants control because, you know, on some level, the only one she completely trusts is herself. And we may see eventually in some of her past that there's a little bit of a reason for that as well. Just as James had his moment with the peppermint and he's remembering being a child and bringing his mom the peppermint tea, this is another moment that is a hearkening to her past and to a simpler time and a more perhaps fondly remembered time by having Tabitha Chorley invoke the same optimism that Lucy used to invoke for her. So yeah, I think you're probably right about that.
Yeah, and as you were talking, something occurred to me, which is that you really do mention that she has this sort of issue with, she respects Catherine, and I think even at this stage she respects Annie, but she butts heads with them. Mm-hmm. And it had never really occurred to me before now, and with us revisiting the stories and just sort of bouncing ideas off one another, that I think a key reason for that is because Abigail has already expressed her dissatisfaction that her life has been decided for her. Mm. At this point, it's been at least twice.
Yeah,
her parents, and to a certain extent, it was her mum who at the town meeting when she overheard what the adults were talking about, her mother was the one who sort of proposed the plan and kind of embodied it to a certain extent. And then when she was sent off to be a cartographer, it was Catherine and Annie discussing it in a room that she never heard the conversation for. So she is quite understandably distrustful of people in positions of authority because she doesn't like the idea that her life can be decided in for her and that her choices can be taken out of her hands. And so when she sees a choice that is, you know, she thinks is the stupid course of action to take, she not only will say, I don't think this is the right thing, but she'll be furious that, oh, this is happening again. Some, like, you know, if I was here and if it were up to me, I would be doing this. And it's not up to me again. Like, she sort of is almost gritting her teeth because she just can't shake this feeling that people are going to keep taking control away from her.
Well, that's actually an interesting question that I'm not sure that I ever completely mined out in terms of who made what choice, because it felt like Catherine was specifically saying, these are the two people I'm putting up as being potential good members for the cartographers. But I wasn't completely certain that agency was necessarily being taken away from James or Abigail, because it certainly seemed like when Frank is taking the measure of James, James is like volunteering and saying, yes, absolutely, there are things that I can do for you. There are skills that can be brought to bear. I want to be a cartographer. And we certainly see that while Abigail is of two minds about going out into the world, there is a very strong feeling in her like there is good that can come out of this. As the very next chapter will point out, one of her goals is to ascertain what happened to her family and the life she was made to leave behind. And by becoming a cartographer rather than continuing to live by the rules set down by Catherine Holloway, she would finally have the freedom to go out and do that. So it's a complicated duality that's going on here. Abigail has essentially gone from having the power to do almost anything at Weirwood but leave it, to a situation where she finally has that freedom, but at the cost of her authority and ability to make all her own decisions. But yeah, I got the overall impression, like, that Catherine was saying, these are the two I recommend both for, most for this. You take your own measure of them and see whether you think they're going to work out. But that, you know, at the end of the day, that it was still James and Abigail agreeing. So I'm like, yeah, okay, we're going to go do this. By the same token, and this is with me not remembering some of the details of the cartographer's handbook, I will eventually get to that, obviously, but going from working together for a small, measurable community is a lot different from being a soldier. And it just occurred to me that Abigail, for the first time in her life, is now experiencing for herself the problems that her father may have had in the Confederate Army. So that's going to be important for her arc as well. So I don't know. I would have to pore over the exact details again to see whether it actually felt like the two of them had a choice in what they were doing, and it's just that James accepted his role and the possibilities for it far more readily. By the same token, as you point out, it may be a looser collar, but being a member of the cartographers is still a collar. It's still not complete freedom for Abigail to do as she would have wished. So, you know, if there is an authority to buck against, Abigail is the one to buck against it, because that's kind of her thing.
I'm telling you, man, she's hammering that renegade button as hard as she can.
Yeah, bear with us, listeners. We're going to be bringing up geek stuff like Mass Effect up again and again. So, yeah.
I'm sorry.
Don't apologize. It's just the only ones that are going to be really confused about this are my parents when they eventually listen to this, because they have no frame of reference for video games for the most part. So,
Yeah, you know what? I think that'll be a similar story with my mum. Hello, mum, if you're listening. I apologize.
I think that brings us to the end of our story for now, unless there are any other topics that you had written down that you wanted to bring up before we close up for the evening.
No, I think that's everything ticked off in a tidy fashion. So all I can say is I'm looking forward to doing more of this. This is hitting its stride.
Absolutely. Well, there isn't as much to talk about this time around because it was the... I mean, obviously, there are going to be some days where there are going to be more talking points that we're going to want to go for individual chapters. That means that episodes of Through the Window are going to be longer or shorter, depending on what's on our list. I think during time of recording this episode, I had started the work of editing down the first few episodes for publication, so I was actually speaking from ignorance as to how long we'd actually talked. This episode was originally 1 hour and 50 minutes long, and that's about average for our talking time, which is part of the reason that I've moved to cutting episodes in half. Sometimes most of that content is going to stay in, and sometimes, like today, my internal editor is snip-happy with the shears, and the actual used amount of talking time, even with the added clips, is down closer to about 1 hour and 15. But I hope that you'll agree that that still makes for a tighter episode overall. But for the moment, it's just that this is both the first 5 chapters and then these 4 chapters are all sort of still very introductory, where there a lot of things are like backstory and introducing overall themes for Secret Rooms and New Century as they mean to go on. It's going to start to get pretty exciting over the next 4 chapters, which is going to be 10 through 13, bringing us to the end of part 1 of Secret Rooms, where... Part 2. Oh, yeah, you're right. Part 1. No, part 1 was the first 5 chapters, yeah. So part 2, setting out. It will bring us to the end of part 2. And as already established, or perhaps not established, by those people who have read the Cartographer's Handbook versus those who haven't, we're already going to have moments where some of the established status quo is going to be thrown up in the air a little bit as more mysteries are revealed and more character development happens, and we want to know more about our intrepid heroes and their past as they move into their future. So I've been Greg.
I've been Toby.
And we'll see you next time on another trip through the Windor. Bye-bye.
Take care.
I don't know how often I'm going to end every episode with another song from my past, as I was going through my rebuilt catalog, and not every set of chapters is going to have something thematic to go with it. So I may find another default outro for those times, but for the end of this episode, I found a pretty good closer. I originally got the Greatest Hits album of Bruce Hornsby because I remembered several of his songs from the radio back in the day. But as my wont, working third shift at the copy shop, I would put on CDs and listen to them all the way through before swapping one out for another. And this was one of the songs that I hadn't heard before, but grew to be a favorite. I imagine these lyrics could apply in many different ways. Annie and Butler are setting James and Abigail in motion after spending too long standing still. They are indeed getting in the saddle, and as their stories progress, our starting foursome will continue to be there for each other, pushing a little harder, and helping out when they stumble. Until the next trip through the Windor, this is Set Me in Motion.
Sit there with a blank expression. Say you can't go on anymore. It's not like me. Come out and help you. Maybe I've been down this road before. Been living in the shadows. Now you come out slow. Now you're in the saddle. Got your ride along. Now the dream was shattered. These days are through. Maybe something. Some are gonna go for broke, some will lay down. so far. And you're the reason I finally got there. You're the reason it's been so hard.
One novel which is tends to be far more from a first person perspective rather than a third person perspective or a like you know in the past perspective. No giggling. We're trying to be good. We're trying not to give away things for people.
But it's so good, Greg. Come on.
But in addition, there's a description of the outside of Weirdwood. I wrote Weirdwood. Okay, that's my fault. Another day, another dollar. But in addition, there is a description of the outside of Weirdwood. I changed the text! Why am I doing this? Gibbet.
The truth is out.
The truth is out about the peppermint. The peppermint was a lie. No, the peppermint was a lie. Alex. Truth.
Alex suddenly goes, good, they found
While she was likely willing to do whatever was needed back in Weirdwood. Okay, that was my fault. I wrote it that way again. As Catherine's get stuff gun girl. I mean, technically that's right. She does get the guns when. Never mind. Finally, this last edit was excised because I felt I was trying to show off my Princess Bride skills again, and instead realized using the original clip would just be clearer. It's the equivalent of the man in black saying, you mean, you put down your rock and I'll put down my sword. Try to kill each other like civilized people? I could kill you now. Frankly, I think the odds are slightly in your favor at hand fighting. It's not my fault being the biggest and the strongest. I don't even exercise.
Sit, Ubu, sit. Good dog.